Lockdown in the middle of a shutdown today, Thursday, October 3rd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. Capitol in lockdown following reports of gunfire outside the building, all while the federal shutdown continues for a third day. Also on the program, oil-rich Venezuela is in danger of going broke. The cost of everything goes up daily, from toilet paper to used pickup trucks.
It always happens. It's the only country that you can buy something and you can use it, and the next day it costs more.
And later, why African migrants make the dangerous ocean journey to Italian shores.
I mean, the answer is simple. They're desperate.
Plus, evading the digital spies.
Nothing has changed since the days of Watergate. If you want to pass secret information, you better find a parking garage somewhere where you can hand it off.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As if Washington needed any more tension, the U.S. Capitol went briefly into lockdown this afternoon after a shooting incident outside the building. Police say the shots were fired during a car chase that ended with a crash near the Capitol. Officials say it was an isolated incident that was not terrorism-related. The other big story in Washington today is, of course, the ongoing shutdown of the federal government. It's in its third day now and threatening to impact a wide array of government agencies. The World's Matthew Bell is with me to explain how the shutdown could affect those agencies handling national security, starting with the military.
Well, Marco, the Pentagon has about 1.4 million uniformed military personnel. They will stay on the job. But the Defense Department also employs about 800,000 civilian employees, and about half of them are now on furlough. That is something that Barack Obama brought up when he put out a pre-recorded message a couple of days ago as the shutdown got started, and he addressed that issue directly.
I know the days ahead could mean more uncertainty, including possible furloughs. And I know this comes on top of the furloughs that many of you already endured this summer. You and your families deserve better than the dysfunction we're seeing in Congress. Your talents and dedication help keep our military the best in the world. That's why I'll keep working to get Congress to reopen our government and get you back to work as soon as possible.
So a message of reassurance there, Marco, but you can also hear the politics in it. This is a big political standoff as well.
So what about U.S. intelligence and counterterrorism operations? I mean, recent comments from the National Intelligence Director on Capitol Hill were pretty darn blunt.
Yes, you're talking about the National Intelligence Director, James Clapper. That was yesterday. He was speaking at the Senate Judiciary Committee. He came out and called the government shutdown a dreamland for foreign intelligence agencies. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
This seriously damages our ability to protect the safety and security of this nation and its citizens. This is not just a beltway issue. This affects our global capability to support the military, to support diplomacy, and to support our policymakers. And the danger here, of course, that this will accumulate over time. The damage will be insidious. So each day that goes by, the jeopardy increases.
Another thing he said, Marco, to the senators there was that 70% of all of the civilian employees that work for U.S. intelligence agencies are also now on furlough.
So Clapper obviously has political reasons to be saying this, but beyond the politics, Matthew, I mean, practically speaking, is he saying that the longer the shutdown goes on, the more likely we are to be cyber attacked, for example?
I think that's precisely the point. I talked to one former Treasury Department official who worked on stopping financing related to terrorist groups and rogue regimes. And he said that's exactly the problem. When you have lots of empty chairs in places like the Treasury Department that does this kind of counterterrorism work, and if it goes on for weeks, maybe even a month, that could be a real missed opportunity. This is work that's not getting done. He explained that chasing financing related to the Iranian government, for example, is like playing whack-a-mole. If you've got people not stopping those different routes for financing to be channeled through, then the money's going to keep flowing.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks for unpacking this for us.
Thank you, Marco.
On day three of the shutdown, it still seems no one has a solution, but you can bet everyone has an opinion, including the millions of social media users in China. Our shutdown is a hot topic of conversation for them right now. David Moser teaches American politics to Chinese students at Capital Normal University in Beijing, and he's been reading the comment threads on Chinese social media sites.
The Chinese netizens that I'm watching on Weibo are somewhat sympathetic with the idea of this sort of breakdown, this sort of conflict, because it shows a real genuine transparent dialogue between the two opposing views of government. And interestingly, I've sort of noticed that the netizens here share a resonance with the Tea Party, believe it or not, but for very different reasons. For one thing, there's a lot of Chinese here that are very suspicious of government and very cynical about its role and are very sympathetic to the idea that it has to be checked. They aren't against big government, which is not an issue here, but they're cynical about corrupt and secretive government. And they're also very sensitive about taxes because they believe that their tax dollars are just going into a black hole and that the government is not accountable at all. And so anything that smacks of wrangling over accountability and frugality in spending of tax dollars sounds like a good idea to them. So they're actually somewhat inclined to kind of see the Republican stance. They're at least open to this debate, and they think it's a healthy sign, actually.
So some of them kind of see what's going on here through a libertarian lens. Just for the corollary, why does the central government see the U.S. government shutdown as a bad thing?
They see it as an irresponsible thing. Of course, there are some sort of reflexive attitudes on the part of the leadership that want to always show the dysfunction of the U.S. system in order to bolster the support for their own system. So they're always saying that the U.S. is not perfect. They're somewhat muted and cautious in their criticism of the partisan squabble, and they're mainly saying that this is an irresponsible act on the part of the government because it has a great potential to negatively influence the global economy. So that's the stance that the state media is taking on this.
You know, so many people have been looking at the government shutdown as kind of the two-party system at its worst, just fighting amongst each other and grinding everything to a halt. When you teach American politics to Chinese students, how hard is it to explain the two-party system to them?
Well, they already have a good understanding of the basics of the two parties. They know that there are two parties, and then they know there are some fundamental disagreements about the role of government. But one thing I've had a hard time explaining to them is the role of money in the system, such as the role of lobbyists and also the role of contributions of various organizations, including multimillionaires and billionaires, to the political system. This seems to them like just open, naked corruption, bribery in some sense. And I have a hard time, in fact, arguing with them that it isn't that.
Have they used the word bribery with you when you get
sure.
into – really?
They say, isn't that just bribery?
And how do you answer that?
I say, in a certain sense, especially from, I guess, the standpoint of the Chinese, in fact, yes, it is a legally sanctioned kind of influence involving large amounts of money that could be considered a kind of corruption, certainly at a high level.
So as an American who's lived in Beijing for a long time, how do you see the U.S. government shutdown from afar?
I can sort of see it from the Chinese point of view because I do understand that accountability, transparency, a genuine sort of partisan debate is exactly what's lacking here. And it's exactly, in some sense, what this country needs more of. The fact that the government has shut down and the American society has not collapsed into chaos is sort of proof to them that the American system is very strong and robust, and the Chinese one remains pretty fragile. It's pretty natural for them to think of the counterfactual of what if the Chinese government shut down for a short time. And they don't think it comes out very well in comparison. I just find it interesting that in this battle, the Chinese citizens kind of seem to side with the American system, and most of the comments on Weibo are kind of veiled attacks at their own Chinese system. On the other hand, as an American, I tend to see this as very dysfunctional. I'm very despairing to see the lack of cooperation between the two parties. And to me, it just seems like an awful mess.
Well, if the shutdown drags on any longer, we'll certainly be checking back in with you, David, to see if those opinions there have changed. Thanks for your point of view.
Thanks, Marco. Glad to talk with you.
David Moser teaches American politics at Capital Normal University in Beijing. Wars are fought in all sorts of ways and in all sorts of places, but these days they're increasingly being waged in the middle of big, dense urban areas. So argues counterinsurgency expert David Kilcullen. Kilcullen has advised many top U.S. officials, including General David Petraeus, and he helped design the American troop surge in Iraq. Kilcullen's new book is called Out of the Mountains, The Coming of Age of the Urban Guerrilla. As evidence of this trend toward urban war, Kilcullen points to the siege of a shopping mall in Nairobi last week and the 2008 terrorist attack in Mumbai, which involved a hotel and a train station.
What we're starting to see is a shift away from the kind of rural insurgency that we've seen in the last decade towards more focus on big urban targets, hotels, shopping malls, railway stations, and a focus on what I've called the urban siege, where people will go in and instead of just attacking and taking hostages or setting off a bomb, they attack and fortify and try to hold an area as long as they possibly can, nearly 100 hours in the case of Nairobi, about 60 hours in the case of the Mumbai attack, and a lot of publicity and influence coming to the respective terrorist groups because of being able to sustain that siege for that length of time.
So who are you arguing is best equipped to try and prevent future attacks like Nairobi or Mumbai in 2008 or what we saw at the Boston Marathon this past April? Is it local police or counterinsurgency units of civilians? Who?
It's paradoxical, but on the one hand, there are no military solutions to these kinds of urban overstretch and rapid growth kinds of challenges that are creating the environment within which this stuff happens. But on the other hand, there's no solutions at all without security. And I think it's much better that that security should come from the community itself and from people that live on the street and can identify what's happening in their own environment. It's very unlikely to imagine a scenario where a lot of white guys with guns going in is the best solution.
I'd love it if you compared London with all its closed-circuit TV cameras and a place like Nairobi, which I'm sure doesn't have anywhere near the number of CCTVs, and what that actually does to prevent urban terrorism.
London is probably the most heavily instrumented piece of urban terrain on the planet right now. It has about 600,000 closed-circuit or other surveillance cameras. It's certainly true that having that amount of surveillance makes it harder for people to operate in that want to attack the city. But I think to the extent that you put those systems in without a really strong partnership and collaboration with the local community, what I call co-design, you can actually be also creating a lot of unrest. The violence that happened in 2011 in London, there was a whole series of fairly substantial riots, has been linked in part to dissatisfaction on the part of people who felt marginalized and disenfranchised within London. They started to see the city as like not their own city, but as somebody else's, and they just lived in it.
So, David, tell us about a city that you believe has figured out the puzzle of preventing urban attacks.
What I see is some hope in a number of different community projects around the place. One of them is in Chicago, an organization called Ceasefire, which is now across about 2 dozen cities in the United States and is also in Europe, is a community-based program to inoculate communities against local violence and also to put people on the street who can monitor and prevent violence before it takes place.
Can a program like Ceasefire, though, I mean, if you're dealing not with gangs but with dogmatically driven extremists, can that succeed?
Urban environment planners and urbanists have talked a lot about co-design and a lot about participatory development. A company out in California called IDEO has pioneered an idea called human-centered design. The challenge that I pose to those guys, which is the challenge that I deal with every day where we work, is how do you do that when somebody's shooting at you without getting dragged into a conflict that looks like Black Hawk Down in Somalia, which happened, you know, 20 years ago today, or something like what we saw in Iraq. And I think that the solutions are almost always things that you don't know up front going into the challenge. When you actually get on the ground and see how the system flows and how it works and start listening to people who live there and combining their knowledge with outside knowledge, that's when the sort of magic happens, if you like, and you start to build together a design that's going to work.
David Kilcullen's new book is called Out of the Mountains, The Coming of Age of the Urban Guerrilla. Thanks very much for joining us, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You can always get the latest from the world's newsroom. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @PRI The World. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The late Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez liked to blame the U.S. for a lot of things. His chosen successor does, too. This week, Nicolas Maduro expelled three American diplomats from the country, accusing them of working with the opposition to sabotage Venezuela's economy and power grid. The U.S. flatly denied the charge and expelled three Venezuelan diplomats in retaliation. But there is a U.S. connection of sorts to at least two of Venezuela's more vexing economic woes: runaway inflation and the scarcity of goods. Reporter Cy Adler explains from Caracas.
In 2007, Jose Rafael purchased a used Chevy truck for about $3,200. Today, he could sell that truck for nearly $24,000.
But it always happens. It's the only country that you can buy something and you can use it, and the next day it costs more.
He's not exaggerating. In August, Venezuela's yearly inflation hit more than 45%. Its scarcity index jumped to 20%, which means that one in five products have disappeared from store shelves. La crisis, as it's being called, has been brought on by a myriad of factors. Its consequences are apparent at El Rincón de Isabel, a family-owned restaurant in the regional capital of Mérida. Señora Torres is the family matriarch.
Un año atrás, no, imagínese, está en 45, 55 bolívares, ya va en 120.
A year ago, imagine a pound of beef cost $3 or $4. Now it costs $9. A year ago, you were able to find ingredients at the supermarket, at any supermarket. Now we have to go from store to store looking for ingredients.
Here's the problem. Venezuela imports 70% of the food it consumes. With its currency, the bolívar, all but worthless internationally, importing food and other goods requires U.S. dollars. The exchange rate is strictly controlled by the Venezuelan government, which also limits the amount of U.S. dollars that people can buy. This dearth of dollars has led to a thriving black market. Good news for underground money changer Rafael Trujillo. This has been going on for 10 years now here in Venezuela, he says. Getting dollars legally through the government is very difficult for business owners, so they get them on the black market. The official exchange rate remains at 6.3 bolivares to the dollar. The black market value is about 40. It's expected to hit 50 or 60 by December. And as economist Luis Zambrano explains, it's the black market, not the government exchange rate, that's setting prices.
Es el ancla de los precios, a donde la gente crea que va a estar el paralelo.
Where people believe the value of the dollar is going to be, the rate at which they think it's going to increase in value, this is the rate at which inflation increases. With faith in the bolivar dropping and speculation on the U.S. dollar rising, importers are required to spend more to bring products into the country. Those higher costs trickle down to restaurant owners, to shopkeepers, and to average Venezuelans. Carlos Lopez, a young professional in Caracas, says his monthly grocery bill nearly quadrupled in the past 8 months alone, and he's had to find a second job just to break even.
La verdad, yo no estoy muy esperanzado.
He says, the truth is I'm not very hopeful. I don't have many plans for the future, because as I've explained, the inflation does not allow for such plans. Sometimes it feels like Venezuela doesn't have much to offer me. This sense of disenchantment and hopelessness is spreading fast. Just over 6 months after the death of Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's socialist dream seems to be in jeopardy. If the government doesn't get some grease on the tracks quickly, the Chavista revolution may just come to a sudden and screeching halt. For The World, I'm Cy Adler, Caracas, Venezuela.
As we heard a few minutes ago, the minute you drive that new model off the dealer's lot in Venezuela, it appreciates in value. Robert Forster runs a Nissan dealership in Caracas, so how many new models do you have for sale in your dealership?
None. Zero.
And why not?
Because I haven't had cars since 2008. That was the year when the government changed the import law, and they prohibited the entrance to Venezuela of imported cars.
Right. So if you can find a new car anywhere in Caracas, it would appreciate in value. That's just how rare they are right now.
Yeah, exactly. It has to do with the supply and demand, and also due to the fact that the currency, the bolívar, is devaluating every day, and people seek to protect their money. and because dollars are scarce, they look to invest in other things, like cars, for example. And because cars are so scarce, they appreciate the minute you buy it and you put them on the street, they appreciate in almost 25-30%.
So how long are your wait lists for new cars?
I don't have wait lists because I haven't had cars for the last 5 years.
Wow. Do you see this changing anytime soon?
Not with the current government.
And what would happen if an American hears this and says, ooh, there's a business opportunity, I'll just drive some new cars overland from the U.S. down to Venezuela?
No, that's going to be very, very difficult because you have to go through a lot of bureaucratic papers and you have to go through a lot of permits, and probably you won't be able to import the cars here. The only cars that are sold in Venezuela are those that belong to the brands that have assembly plants in Venezuela. That would be Mitsubishi, that would be Toyota, that would be Ford, that would be General Motors. But the rest of us, that's Nissan, that's Honda, that's Mercedes-Benz, that's Audi, that's BMW, and don't have a chance to do business in Venezuela right now, not with the current conditions.
Yeah, and you run a Nissan dealership. How do you stay in business, Robert?
Just selling spare parts and service.
Wow, how's that working out?
Well, it's not working very well. I've made break-even since 2008, but I'm not making any money. Basically, the financial structure of a dealership is made in a sense that what you sell from spare parts and service, you pay off the bills, and the earnings come out from the sales of new cars. So, in a sense, I'm not making money since 2008. I'm just holding on. It's a decision we've taken due to the fact that this is a family business that has been running for 40 years. So it's not so easy just to shut it down. But if things continue the way they are and government decisions do not change, then it will be inevitable in some time that we have to close.
So is the situation so bad that even good condition used cars, or as you guys like to say, pre-owned, are also appreciating in value?
Very, very much, Marco. Even
wow.
They're even used cars or secondhand cars that can cost more than new cars.
Wow, that's a very serious situation, it seems.
Yes. It's due to the fact, what I told you earlier, that the Bolívar is devaluating every day. So it makes absolutely no sense to have Bolívares in your savings account. The lack of dollars since almost a year and a half prevents from people from saving their money in hard currency. So what do? They tend to buy things, houses, cars, electronic equipments, everything that you can get your hands on that somehow protects the value of your money.
So cars, houses, they're a hedge against inflation in a country where a gallon of gas costs like 25 cents?
Well, less. I mean, I can fill up a 50-liter tank with five bolívares. That would be less than $5 cents.
All right. I've had my mind officially blown on this Thursday. Thank you very much, Robert Forrester, for speaking with us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Robert Forrester runs a Nissan dealership in Caracas, Venezuela. And you're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, building a more private search engine, but it's still up to you.
I think it's really important to think of what you do online as being public, because the only real protection you have against accidentally revealing information that you don't want to reveal is by maintaining, I think, that level of paranoia.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Seems like no communication is safe from the NSA, or at least from speculation that the government is snooping on it. This week, the head of the National Security Agency denied reports that his outfit had run surveillance on American social media accounts. But really, who isn't feeling monitored? That's one of the reasons two computer guys in Berlin started BlipX. It's a project that's trying to reinvent the way we use internet search engines. Step one, rank pages by how long people spend on a website. Step two, make it private. Now, that second objective, well, even BlipX co-founder Max Kosatz admits it's really an impossible task.
The only thing we can do is make it really hard for everyone, especially for them, to get the data.
Them being the NSA, of course. So the goal for BlipX is to make it as hard as possible for them to track your digital trail. Nice idea, huh? Well, Christopher Mims is a technology writer with Quartz. Christopher, what do you make of projects like BlipX? Can they really deliver a search engine experience that's really private?
I think that they can get us awfully close. So BlipX works by not gathering data in the first place. So Google gives us what's called a personalized search. When you're logged in, it's gathering information about what you're searching for. And if you're in Gmail and other Google apps, it's using that data to personalize the ads that it shows you as well. And BlipX is just very, very scrupulous about not capturing anything in the first place. So if they don't have a log of that data, no hacker can ever steal it and no government can ever subpoena it.
Isn't not gathering data, though, a business death knell for a search engine?
That's a good point. So when you talk to the guys behind BlipX and you ask them what their business model is, they say, we have no idea. But as we've seen with, for example, Twitter, which is about to have an IPO and probably be worth many billions of dollars, you don't have to have a business model in the internet economy for years.
So you've been using BlipX. Does it work? Do you feel private?
So the funny thing is that I am not somebody who is obsessed with internet privacy. I just assume that every time I touch a computer, every single keystroke is available to a government body somewhere. But I use the BlipX plugin, which shows me BlipX's search results alongside Google's when I search Google. And I find that very useful because BlipX's way of ranking pages is different enough from Google that it surfaces interesting results.
You know, in this age when we know what the NSA is up to, why do you feel comfortable with the knowledge that everything you search, everything you do online is being watched?
I think it's really important to think of what you do online as being public, because the only real protection you have against accidentally revealing information that you don't want to reveal is by maintaining, I think, that level of paranoia. So, you know, I'm not part of an international criminal syndicate and I don't have anything that I'm particularly worried about hiding from the government right now. But if I had very unpopular political views or there was some other reason that I didn't want something to be public, I wouldn't put it on the internet and I wouldn't communicate it by that means. I mean, I'm a journalist. Occasionally, I will have conversations with people that I don't want there to be a record of, other than a record that I control. And, you know, that's what the telephone is for. Obviously, the NSA has access to those call records as well. But, you know, there's no substitute for in-person conversation. There's no substitute for sharing things directly with your friends in a physical format. I just think that the nature of the internet is it is a surveillance machine, and we can go to elaborate ends to try to quote unquote protect ourselves in that context. But security experts will tell you that there's no such thing as perfect security ever.
So can you make a search engine that is 100% NSA proof?
You can to the level that most people want it to be. So if you are engaging in activities that you absolutely need to keep secure, then you need to find another way to search and you need to consult with experts. If you're just an everyday person who doesn't like the idea that the government is spying on everything that you do, which is, I think, the overwhelming majority of people who are upset about these NSA leaks, then there are tons of technologies you can use to kind of annoy the NSA and make it more difficult. So in a way, it might be a symbolic act of protest, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
Bottom line, though, is if you want something really private, go to a park and meet somebody and don't let anybody hear it. Or
nothing has changed since the days of Watergate. If you want to pass secret information, you better find a parking garage somewhere where you can hand it off.
Christopher Mims, a technology writer with Quartz. Thanks so much for your time.
That was fun.
This next story shows you that one person's activist is another's pirate. 30 Greenpeace activists are facing piracy charges in Russia. They were arrested after staging a protest at an offshore oil rig in the Arctic. That rig is run by Russia's state-controlled company, Gazprom. Now, Greenpeace says the protest was peaceful. They also call the piracy charges absurd. Whatever the case, the accused are now being held in the northern city of Murmansk and could be sentenced to 15 years in jail. Freelance journalist Charles Maines is in St. Petersburg. Tell us what happened up there in the Arctic with Greenpeace.
Well, this was part of a wider Arctic campaign by Greenpeace against drilling in the Arctic. They've been holding various events throughout the year. This particular case, they took their ship, the Arctic Sunrise, close to a Gazprom, this is the Russian oil gas conglomerate, drilling platform in the Pechora Sea. This is in Russian territorial waters, where they were hoping to hang their Greenpeace signs on the ship. And Greenpeace activists tried to climb the ship, but were rebuffed by Russians. And then later, the Arctic Sunrise, the Greenpeace ship, was overtaken by Russian special forces and brought back to Murmansk.
I mean, Greenpeace has been waging peaceful protests around the world for decades, occasionally mixing it up with local governments. But why is Russia moving now to press piracy charges against everyone on the ship?
Well, it's a good question. And I think part of this, you know, I think it's likely to turn into a big international scandal. We're talking about 30 individuals from 19 countries, including Russian nationals, people from Europe, North America, Latin America, Australia. And it's interesting also because this happened against the backdrop of the Olympics. Russia will host the Olympics in Sochi beginning in February. Already these Olympics have become something, you know, where there are a lot of, say, side stories and scandals that perhaps the Russian government would not emphasize, including this anti-gay law. There was a Dutch journalist who was essentially kicked out this week. And now it appears that this case will move forward against the Greenpeace activists for piracy. And so essentially you have the world, Russia hosting the world while it is also imprisoning the world. So it's hard to imagine this promotes a very positive image of Russia.
Right. And those Greenpeace activists are now sitting in a prison in Murmansk. What's that like? How are conditions in the Murmansk prison?
Well, conditions there, it's a large prison, holds about 1,000 people. A friend of mine is, in fact, one of the – a former colleague and friend is one of the activists there. His wife or longtime partner went to go see him the other day and had access to him for about an hour and a half. And she describes essentially what probably most people would think of a Russian prison. It's not a particularly pleasant place, but on the other hand, they're being treated fairly well, according to my friend. This is the radio journalist Andrei Alekhverdov, who has been working with Greenpeace over the last 6 months.
He's a former journalist, now an activist with Greenpeace. What's his alleged crime? Also piracy?
Also piracy. He was a press officer aboard the Arctic Sunrise. But as we've seen today with these charges, the Russian government isn't delineating between the various roles of those on the crew. So everyone from the captain to the cook to the press officer to the actual activists who tried to mount onto this oil rig platform, they're all being charged with the same thing.
Now, I know in the past 5 years, there's been intense interest among many countries, Russia and the U.S. especially, in the oil that lies up in the Arctic. Is Greenpeace targeting what Russia is doing in the Arctic, or are they opposed to all oil exploration and extraction up there?
They're opposed to oil drilling that might harm the environment. And one of their arguments in terms of Gazprom is that the conditions of this rig aren't safe and that basically you're waiting for an accident to happen. You know, I think it's worth pointing out that in the Russian media, there have been a lot of efforts to discredit Greenpeace. They're touted essentially as an American-run organization, and that their mission is not so much environmentalism as to kind of attack Russian sovereignty over this territory. And it was interesting today, Russian President Vladimir Putin made comments that, in fact, this Arctic shelf is an extension of Russia's national interests, and, you know, that this was something that had always been part of Russia's territory and would remain so in the foreseeable future.
You know, this could turn into another high-profile case involving protesters in Russia along the lines of Pussy Riot and could attract international condemnation. Is that where things are heading?
I think so. I mean, I don't see, unless someone in Russia, someone high up, takes a look at what's happening and decides that this is just isn't worth, you know, the kind of distraction, again, ahead of the Olympics, which start in February. And I can see this being a major sort of nuisance to the Russians as they go about trying to, you know, they obviously want to project a positive image of Russia in February as they host the Games. And this is not helping their case at all.
Freelance journalist Charles Maines in St. Petersburg, Russia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think it's fair to say that Americans don't really like to get naked in public, so it'll be a while before we have the skybox sauna. But they've got one in Finland. Mina Kumen is a hospitality manager at the Hartwell Arena in Helsinki, Finland. So how does this work, Mina? You strip down and watch a hockey game in the buff, is that it?
Yes, it is. Well, that's what people do in the saunas in Finland. They sit there naked, yes.
Right.
It's very popular.
So, I mean, what happens when you walk in there? What do you see? What does it look like, this room?
When you walk into the sauna, you just, there's a dark window that you can see out. But you can't see from the spectators can't see inside to the sauna. And that makes it very interesting because I have had a lot of people saying that the most question is that, are you sure they can't see in?
Yeah,
because
right.
I can see out.
Right. Is it pretty luxurious? Do you just get the sauna? You get some food and drink as well?
Yeah, you may eat your hot dog there, for example, and have a beer at the sauna and watch ice hockey. That's possible, yes. You can have a fancy menu, like a three-course menu, or you just can have, for example, chips and hot dogs, hamburgers.
Chips in a sauna seems like they're going to get pretty soggy pretty fast.
Yeah.
has there been much curiosity from tourists and people unfamiliar with this kind of way of viewing a sporting event?
Yes, we get a lot of attention because sauna is not very familiar in the other countries. Not, for example, in Japan. I have had one tourist group who took about 36 rolls of film. So, yes, just from the sauna.
We're all kind of chuckling about it, but, I mean, saunas are important to the Finns. I mean, many homes have them, right? It's kind of like a dishwasher in the United States. Finns just have a sauna in their home, right?
It's a long, long tradition because Finland is a very cold country. So it's nice to come home from work or exercise and you just heat it up and go to sauna. In Florida, I understand you don't need a sauna because you're in a sauna all day.
Yeah, right.
So.
Mina, what is the hockey team that plays at the Hartwall Arena?
Jokerit.
Are you a fan?
Oh, yes. I have been a Joker fan all my life, and that's true. It's not just because I work there.
And what kind of perspective do you get on a hockey match from a sauna bath?
Well, it was when arena was open 1997, and we had our first world championships. There was a men's team at the Skybox balcony, and they came just to chill up after being in a hot sauna, and they just had their towels on. So when the Finnish team scored, the guys just jumped up and cheered for Finland. And they kind of forgot they had just towels on. So that's when I had to run. The hospital manager ran up there and say, boys, you need to go inside and put your clothes on when you come to the balcony.
Interesting little emergency there.
Yeah, sometimes I need to do my work.
Mina Kumen is a hospitality manager at the Hartwall Arena in Helsinki. Great to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Finland was one of Ronald Reagan's last overseas trips as president. I don't think he tried the sauna. That would have won some extra admirers. But then again, the late president was always very popular in Europe. He still is a crowd pleaser in places like Poland. The Poles credit Reagan with helping to topple communism in their former Soviet bloc country. Here he is in 1982 talking about Poland's crackdown against the Solidarity labor movement.
I emphasize my belief that a tangible alliance response to the Polish crisis must be made now. Should we fail to insist that the Soviet Union stop pressuring Poland directly and indirectly, the gravest consequences for international relations could ensue.
Last year, a statue honoring President Reagan was erected in the birthplace of Solidarity, the Baltic port city of Gdansk. Well, it seems someone was eager to take a chunk of Reagan home. Police are looking for a vandal who made off with one of the statue's arms. The damage was initially estimated at more than $30,000, but the artist who made it said it could be fixed within weeks for far less money. Ironically, given Reagan's politics, it was the statue's left arm that was stolen. You've probably heard me mentioning our new website recently. If you head to PRI.org, you'll notice a lot of changes. PRI.org is our new digital home. It's a work in progress, and we'd love to hear from you about it. What works? What can we fix? Let us know what you think. Just head to PRI.org. You're tuned to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A boat carrying hundreds of migrants from Africa sank today in the Mediterranean Sea, just short of its intended destination, the Italian island of Lampedusa. At least 100 people drowned, and over 200 are missing. This is not an isolated incident, sadly. Hundreds die each year in similar tragedies, part of a constant exodus of African asylum seekers going to Europe for refuge. Reporter Megan Williams in Rome has been to Lampedusa many times. What is known so far about this tragedy, Megan?
Well, I think this is the worst one that has ever happened off the coast of Lampedusa, which is a southern Sicilian island. Early this morning, a boat with approximately 500 people, half a mile from the coast of Lampedusa, so not very far, caught fire. Now, apparently what happened is the motor broke and the boat was flooded with water. People panicked, so they lit a sheet on fire, but gasoline had mixed with the water, so the whole boat caught fire and people started jumping into the water. Two fishing vessels saw the fire and came to their rescue, but of course couldn't put all those people on a boat, called the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard came, but by then, you know, many people have drowned.
So they started that fire to attract attention to their problematic situation. The boat's 70 feet long, and they had nearly 500 people on board. I mean, that just seems insane.
It does, but it's very typical of the type of boats that cross over from Libya. Most of them, they're generally people from Somalia, from Eritrea. This boat had people from Ghana as well. They're people who have traveled from conflict situations, come to Libya, pay traffickers, and get on these incredibly dangerous little boats.
You said a few of these people on this boat were from Ghana. Have you ever met one of these migrants and just asked them, you know, given the risks, why did they come?
Oh, yeah, I've met a lot of them over the years. I mean, a few years ago, there were about 5,000 from Tunisia. The answer is simple. They're desperate. They come from places where there's war. They're often family members have been killed. They can't make a living. Libya used to be a place that welcomed a lot of African migrant workers, but since the civil war there and the turmoil, those people can't find jobs there anymore. So even more people have come over since.
Reporter Megan Williams in Rome, thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
Serious record collecting is a labor of love. It takes countless hours and a fair amount of cash. One label owner in Frankfurt, Germany, figured out a creative way to finance his fixation for African music. Caitlin Carroll has his story.
Sammy Ben Rejeb grew up in Tunisia. He moved to Senegal to DJ and teach diving. And he spent his free time hunting for rare records all over Africa.
And so after doing that for 5-6 years, I started feeling kind of a pressure because I was spending all my money on traveling. And I remember a friend of mine came to see me and said, you know what, Sammy, I just found a job with Lufthansa. And if you don't know what to do, this is probably now the right time because they really need personnel. So I thought, that might be a good idea.
Ben Rejeb applied, got hired as a flight attendant in Germany, and chose a route that took him back to Africa. It was the perfect job for him. He flew to Lagos, Addis Ababa, and Accra on a monthly basis.
And then there I started having like connections who were looking for records for me. And then every time I was going, they had already prepared stuff that I just listened through and then selected what I wanted and then flew back with that.
Ben Rejeb made thousands of trips to Africa while working for Lufthansa and brought back countless pieces of music.
And that's basically how I really managed to get all this record collection, which is now the base for my label.
Ben Rejeb runs his label, Analog Africa, out of a packed apartment in Frankfurt. He selects tracks from his many rare records to create new compilations.
Yes, this is what I'm going to say so you're going to know what I'm going to do.
The most recent release, Afrobeat Airways 2, focuses mainly on Ghanaian music from the 70s. This track from the band Complex Sounds showcases some of the horn-heavy high life style that was so huge in Ghana. Ben Rejeb got turned on to the 70s music scene on one of his visits to Accra.
While I was there, I was looking for records and talking to musicians and to collectors, and they were telling me about how vibrating the music scene was there. It was difficult for me to picture really what was going on. But then I found stamps of a photo studio.
Accra's Modern Photo Company. It was located next to one of Accra's hottest clubs in the 70s, the Tiptoe. So Ben Regev went to the photo studio to see if he could track down one of the old photographers.
And believe it or not, the guy was there, the photographer, and he said, well, how can I help?
Ben Regev asked if he could see some of the photos of the bands who used to play in Accra a few decades ago. He was led to the back of the studio, where dozens of boxes lined the shelves.
I stayed in that room for about 3-4 hours. All the pictures were in small boxes, yellow Kodak boxes, were all marked with a marker. Like, it was really like a gold mine in a way.
Back in the 70s, Ghana was a musical petri dish. Soul, Afrobeat, and jazz mixed with funk and highlife. Bands from around Africa and abroad came to Ghana to perform, like the Côte d'Ivoire group Pierre Antoine and Vis-a-Vis. Toward the end of the 70s, political instability had undermined Ghana's music scene. Curfews went into effect and clubs closed down.
So if you have curfews and the musician cannot play, the whole scene went dead. And this for basically political reasons that actually didn't bring the country any way further, you know. So it's a very sad story, and we are left with all this picture to actually remind you, and all this music to remind you of what was going on.
Ben Regev sought out the musicians featured on the compilation to ask permission to use their songs. He also included interviews with them in the colorful 44-page CD booklet. Some musicians were surprised to see the songs resurrected, he says. Others expected it, saying, if you do something good, it should be remembered forever. For The World, I'm Caitlin Carroll, Frankfurt.
That's all from us. We've got lots more online at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.